Mr. Chris Allman, thank you. Is a four-time national international whistling grand champion. Yes, a whistling grand champion. He's performed with orchestras for presidents at major sporting events and on The Tonight Show. His repertoire includes classical, blues, jazz, Broadway, rock, and patriotic songs. Annually, he serenades more than 500 people on their birthdays. Whose birthday is it today, by the way? Somebody's birthday in here. You're lying. In June 2017, Chris published a book, Find Your Whistle, Simple Gifts Through Hearts and Change Lives. And in 2012, he was inducted into the International Whistling Hall of Fame. Do I have that right? It's international, too? Pretty cool. By day, he's a director of global communications at the Carlyle Group. If you get a chance, check out his TED Talk, or TED Whistle, entitled Whistling for the President. Today, Chris will focus with us on the power of the individual to touch a heart and to change a life with their simple gift. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Chris.
There we go. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. And yes, there actually is something called the International Whistling Competition. For anyone who's ever been near the town of Lewisburg, North Carolina, it's just north of Raleigh. That is the international home of whistlers, believe it or not. You've probably driven by it many times, and you don't know what you're missing when you go by there. And that's where the Hall of Fame is located, too. Actually, I think it's like someone keeps it in their living room and they take it out once a year for the competition. So I am super delighted to be here. I appreciate Daryl Glick's invitation. And I think you all found me because I have a son at the Heights in ninth grade and a daughter at Oakcrest. And so I'm part of the family, the Opus Dei family. So it's really a super delight to be here. And so people say, well, how did you become a whistler? And I say, well, it was incremental. So I started when I was around 5 years old. My father was a pretty good whistler, and I'd follow him around the yard and the house, and he'd whistle Gilbert and Sullivan songs and other things. So that's how I actually learned how to whistle. But I had these key moments along the way. When I was 13 to 16, I had a paper route. I grew up on Long Island in New York. So I'd whistle for 2 hours every day while riding my little Schwinn Stingray around the neighborhood, delivering papers. And back then, it was more of a volume thing than quality. People would say, well, I heard you coming. They never said much about whether it was good or not, or whether they recognized it. And then when I was in college, I started whistling with blues and jazz bands, and which was really a lot of fun. I remember the first time this happened, where I was watching a friend. He had a jazz band. And at the break, I just went up to him and just thought just popped in my head, and I said, do you ever let people perform with you? And he looks at me and he says, well, you don't play any instrument. And I said, no, I whistle. And he said, oh, okay, well, let's give it a try. So that was the first time I ever performed and live in front of an audience doing improvisational whistling. And at first there was some like catcalling and obnoxiousness from the audience, but people in the end liked it, and it was an encouragement to me over time. So then I moved to Washington after I graduated, and I had this key moment, and I was in the Shenandoah National Park hiking Old Rag with some friends and whistling, of course. And a friend of a friend says, wow, you're good. You should do something with that. And I say, well, I heard there's a competition, but I don't know where it is or anything about it. And the mutual friend said, well, if it exists, I will find it. So we do the hike. She comes back to Washington. And she goes to this building. It's called a library. It has books in it. And people don't go to those anymore because they have the internet. But in 1992, there was no internet. So sure enough, she finds the national and international whistling convention in good old Lewisburg. So I send away for information, and I sign up, and sure enough, I win a prize. In 1993 was the first time I competed, and I whistled. Well, if you know Glenn Miller, that's In the Mood by Glenn Miller. So I whistled that, and I won second prize in the popular category. So I thought, wow, this is cool. So the next year I came back and said, I'm going to win that darn thing. And I practiced all year. And so the next year I won the international championship. And life just went bonkers because I have a day job, in case any of you are wondering. So so I had to mix my emerging whistling career with my day job doing communications. And at that time I was working on Capitol Hill for a congressman. So I was on The Tonight Show, I was on The Today Show, I did hundreds of radio interviews, I was on C-SPAN, as geeky as you get, but I was the Capitol Hill whistler, so they had to have the whistler on. So, to paraphrase Jerry Garcia from The Grateful Dead, what a long, strange trip it's been. Because for the past 30 years or so, I've just had this array of really interesting, poignant, like tearjerker, just joyous experiences because of whistling. And so it was this intersection between my lips and Wall Street and Capitol Hill and politics. So, for example, I had the chance to whistle for George Bush in the Oval Office. And that is a totally fascinating story because I worked at OMB. I was a spokesman there at the beginning of his administration. But I was not in his orbit, so I didn't actually know George Bush. I'd never been in the Oval Office. But one day, I got summoned there. I went into the staff meeting with the director, and he said, "The meeting's canceled. But Ullman, you stay." Now, when you're a spokesman, you know that's bad news because we're just one bad quote away from losing our jobs. But sure enough, he said, he has this kind of Cheshire grin, and he looks at me and he says, "Get your jacket. We're going to the Oval Office to whistle for the president." And I said, that just can't be. And he said, "It is, so let's go. And you don't leave the president waiting." So I ran, I went to my office, got my jacket, but I quickly called my wife and I said, "Chris," her name's Chris also, and I said, "Chris, I'm going to the Oval Office to whistle for the president." She says, "Can I come?" And I said, "No, got to go, sorry." So we walk over to the Oval Office, and it is an indelible mark in my brain. Because I walk in, I'd never been in there, and George Bush is sitting at his desk. He's got his feet up on his desk, and he's got an unlit cigar in his hand, just kind of hanging out, which, you know, I guess that's what presidents do. And then, So then he sees me, and he runs around to the other side of the desk, and he comes up to me and he said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Do you sit? Do you stand? Do you need some water? Who taught you how to whistle?" And I said, "Dude." I said, "No." I said, "I'm moist and puckered. I'm ready to go." Okay. So we chit-chatted for a few minutes, and we had a really delightful conversation. And then, like, out of the blue, he says, "Whistle for me." That was, like, my first ever presidential directive. So I felt I had to rise to the challenge. And I said, and this is a dangerous question to ask if you don't know the answer. I said, "Well, what kind of music do you like?" And he said, "Country Western." And I said, "Oh, yeah." I just don't know a lot of country Western because I grew up on classical music. If he said Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, boom, all four movements, I'm in. But country Western, I don't think so. So then I thought, aha. I said, "How about the Lone Ranger song?" And he said, "That's perfect." Now, I didn't have the heart to tell him it's an Italian opera, but... It goes on and on and on. But anyway, George Bush was happy, so that's a good thing. So what I've done over time is just try to find opportunities to share my simple gift with people. And I had, I've turned my whistling into a ministry, effectively. So I whistle Happy Birthday around 500 times a year for people. And I mean, I believe you share this sentiment. What is the greatest gift of all is the gift of life. And it is our duty to honor it. And this is my way of honoring people's lives. So I just love to call people up on their birthdays and serenade them. And I have all these like funky experiences that come about as a result of it, where when people are expecting the whistle, they usually won't answer the phone. So it's on one hand, it's kind of rude, but I say, no, they want a recording of it. So sometimes I'll get people live, and I say, "Hey, it's Chris," and they're like, "Oh," and they're like, oh, we wanted to get the recording. I said, no, no, I'll do it twice. I'll do it live, and then I'll do a different version recorded. And they're like, oh, cool. All right, so that's good. So as you can imagine, when you whistle 500 happy birthdays a year, it's logistically challenging. So I had this amazing experience where I was on a plane. We were it just left the gate in out of Istanbul, flying to Hong Kong. And I'm settling in. It's a several-hour flight. And suddenly my phone rings. And it's my wife, and she says, have you whistled for Becky yet? It's her Becky's birthday. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm in Turkey. I'm sorry. I screwed up. She's like, listen, it's Becky's birthday, and Becky is our babysitter's mother. Now, you all know, if you have little kids and you like date night, you better keep the babysitter and her mother happy. So I said, listen, I'm about to take off. Even the flight attendants are seated. She's like, date night, click. And I'm like, uh-oh. So I scanned the cabin. I didn't see any of the flight attendants. I said, what the heck? So I ran to the bathroom. I speed dialed Becky. I get her voicemail, thankfully, and I do a very swift and crisp rendition of Happy Birthday. I flush for effect. Then I run back to my seat. Just as the wheels are taking off, date night lives on. So does anyone have a birthday today, or is in the kind of the orbit of your birthday or the penumbra of your birthday, if there are any lawyers here? Someone must have. All right. So stand up. Tell us your name. James, have you ever been serenaded by a champion whistler? Well, prepare yourself. Okay, here we go. All right. It is true you have to wet your whistle. Okay. All right, here we go. Happy birthday, James. Okay. So I had this this really interesting opportunity to give a TED Talk. And people have probably heard of TED Talks. And there's one in Washington called TEDx Mid-Atlantic. And the way it came about was I work at the Carlyle Group, which is a global investment firm. And I run the global communications. And one of my bosses, David Rubenstein, who's a noted philanthropist, was giving a talk on philanthropy. So I was backstage, like the PR guy usually is, waiting for the boss. And David finishes the talk. He walks off. And then the organizer kind of escorts us out. And as we're leaving, the organizer says, hey, we're organizing next year's TEDx. If you know anyone who's got something interesting to say, let me know. So I gave him my card. And I just said, look me up. I didn't say anything else. So then 6 months go by, and I get this random phone call and with just a string of expletives and excitement saying, you didn't tell me you're a blah, blah, blah whistler. This is incredible. And then he said, you need to do a TED Talk. And I said, well, cool. And then he said, what will you talk about? And I said, I have no idea. I'm a good whistler, but who the heck cares if I'm a good whistler? And he said, well, think about it. So I spent months thinking about why would anyone care that I can whistle well? And so I started making a list of all of my cool experiences, whether it's whistling for the president in the Oval Office or whistling happy birthday for folks. I've even whistled at the top of the Washington Monument on the outside, holding on to that aluminum top, which is another story I'll tell you about. And so I've just had this array of experiences, which are fun, and they'll make you cry, and just really interesting. But what's the point? You know, a TED Talk has to have a point. But in the end, I concluded that this is a simple gift. And I realize that we have a very hero-centric culture. We love our heroes. They could be movie stars or sports heroes or people who've cured cancer or survived cancer or rode across the Atlantic single-handedly. And I thought, wow, I'm none of that. I haven't done any of those things. And then I thought, wow, it's the power of simplicity is really what my gift is to take this simple thing, which I have developed, but in the end, it is a simple gift, and to be able to touch the heart of the President of the United States for 20 minutes to bring him a little joy, or to call kids or people on their birthdays and say, your life matters, and I'm just going to celebrate your life for a few minutes. And that is really the point. So that was the point of my talk, and my concluding words in my TED talk were, now go find your whistle. And it's really, and that's why this has turned into a ministry for me, is that, you know, I have my gift. My gift is whistling, but each of you has a gift as well. And the key is to find it, hence the name of the book, Find Your Whistle. Simple gifts touch hearts and change lives. So while I was writing, then my wife said, listen, you need to write a book about this. This is really great. And even if no one buys it, your kids will know what you've done or what you've inflicted on the world, one or the other. Okay. So while I was writing it, I concluded that I think people would grow tired of hearing about my stories. So I decided I would feature people whose whistles touched my heart. So I came up with 10 people who run the gamut in terms of what their whistle is, but that have touched my heart in these really simple, super simple ways, but that bring me joy. So I'm gonna read one of those for you, and this is my mom. So my mom's name is Fran Ullman. And the way I do it is I have these little two-page kind of spreads with a nice pen and ink drawing of each of the 10 people and a little blurb about what their whistle is and how it affects me. So this is my mom. So her whistle is empathy, and this is how I know her. So we met on May 9th in 1963 at 3:16 p.m. in the delivery room of the Peck Memorial Hospital in Brooklyn, New York, though I have no recollection of the blessed event. So it's her whistle in action. So in our kitchen growing up hung a plaque. Great spirit, grant that I might not criticize my neighbor until I have walked a mile in his moccasins. And that well captures my mother's spirit of empathy, which pervades her thoughts and deeds. It's as if her own challenging childhood gave her a window into the hidden struggles that so many of us have. And when my siblings and I complained of annoying grade school classmates, mom's response was universally, be nice to them, they have problems at home. And though the response itself was frustrating to a preteen seeking validation of grievances, over time it seeped into my soul. Today, when I show compassion to someone in need, it's my mom's heart and love I'm channeling. Her empathy is so simple, but so mind-bogglingly deep. It comes from a complex place I will never truly comprehend. And it manifests itself in ways that are obvious and devoid of rationale, as pure love should be. And it is instinctual and joyous. And because of her, I try hard to ask questions and actually listen to the answers. I've learned to extend a hand rather than a finger, and I've seen that the journey is better if the shoes I'm wearing aren't always mine. So that is Fran Ullman, who is a remarkable person. And so I feature 9 other people. I feature a wonderful Catholic priest named Father Michael Sliney, who is a legionary. And his gift, and maybe some of you are on his list, he sends out a daily email with a video and usually a quote from a saint or, you know, a wise person with like 2 sentences of reflection on it. And I get this every day, and it's this amazing gift, and it's so simple but he shares it so lovingly and simply and with people. I feature another Catholic priest named Father John Adams, who runs So Others Might Eat, which is the shelter that helps homeless people. And his whistle is love, and he's dedicated 40-plus years of his life to helping people in need and doing it with joy and with humility. It's truly, truly remarkable. And so one of the things that I'm trying to get across through the book and through my talks is very much an empowerment message, to get everyone in the room to think, all right, well, Ullman's a whistler, good for him. Well, what's my gift? And have I found it, and have I developed it, and have I shared it with people, you know, in a way that enables us to make the world a better place, just one person at a time? Because if you're stuck in the hero mentality, then you think, well, my little thing, my contribution is just too small. And I say, no, get away from that, because there are not enough heroes in the world to solve the world's problems. It's really incumbent upon us and our simple gifts. One of the other people I feature is a man who makes carrot cake for me once a year. And it's someone who used to be on my team when I was in the government. And every year he makes carrot cake. It's the best carrot cake in the world. And he does it voluntarily. I don't pay him for it. He calls me up 2 weeks before New Year's Eve and says, hey, you want your carrot cake? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And it's such a simple thing. He doesn't have to do it. but it brings me joy. It's really amazing. And something from Scripture really drove this home to me over Pentecost, this past Pentecost Sunday. And so we were at church, and the reading was from 1 Corinthians, and here's a little bit of it. It says, "There are different kinds of spiritual gifts, but the same Spirit. There are different forms of service, but the same Lord. There are different workings, but the same God, who produces all of them in every one. To each individual, the manifestation of the Spirit is given for some benefit." And this is astounding. My 11-year-old turned to me and said, "Daddy, that's what your book is about." And I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. It hadn't even occurred to me while I was hearing it. But into her little heart, she heard those words, and she said, that captures it so well. So that ultimately, that's what we're trying to do, is to get to empower people to realize the power of thinking small. Don't worry about the whole world. Think about the person next to you. Think about this. From every day, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, you will encounter scores of people, literally scores of people. Do we commit ourselves to loving them, to, you know, bearing witness, to sharing your gift, and not just making each of these encounters just some fleeting thing? Now, of course, you have to, you know, it's all about appropriateness. If you're just buying a newspaper from someone, you know, you're not going to spill your guts to them. But at the same time, you are interacting with another one of God's children. And are you smiling? And are you loving? Are you... You know, if it's a tense situation, are you de-escalating? Are you giving people the benefit of the doubt? And that is really the power of simplicity and the power of the individual to touch the heart and the life of the person you're with at that moment. So it's really pretty incredible. How are we doing on time? Okay. All right. I mentioned earlier the top of the Washington Monument. So this is an amazing story, where you may recall in 2011. There was an earthquake, and it damaged the Washington Monument. So my boss said, "Well, you know, I'll pay for half of it." So it helps to have lots of money. So he agreed to pay half, and so they started repairing, and they put up the scaffolding on the exterior of it. So every day I would drive by it on the way to work, and you know, every day is a new level going up and up and up. And I do PR for a living, so I'm always looking for cool photo ops and things like that. And then one day it just popped in my head. I said, "Wow, we should do a photo shoot at the top of the Washington Monument, on the outside." I bet that's never happened. So I called the National Park Service, and they say, "Well, I don't know, there's all sorts of legal issues." And I'm like, "Come on, this would be cool, man, photo shoot at the top." And they say, "All right, we'll think about it." So they get back to me, and they say, "Yes." So then I have to go get David to agree. So I said, "David, you want to do a photo shoot at the top of the Washington Monument?" He said, "On the inside?" I said, no, on the outside." He's like, yeah, let's do that. Anyway, so this came to pass. So that morning, we were standing at the base of the Washington Monument, and we look up, and he said, "I bet no one's ever whistled at the top of the Washington Monument." And I said, "I bet you're right. If they were whistling, it was out of fear, you know." So I said, "What song do you think I should do?" And he said, "Yankee Doodle Dandy," in honor of George Washington. So I'm going to do that, and get your lips ready, because I'm going to do that into Grand Old Flag, and then I'm going to stop, and then you're going to whistle Yankee Doodle Dandy with me. All right. Now, are you ready? If you can't whistle, you can hum, and if you can't do those, you can sing. So, you ready? 1, 2, 3. Thank you. Beautiful. I love it. All right. So we have time for a couple of questions, if anyone. If you don't, I'm going to whistle one more song, but you're free to ask a question. Yes, ma'am. Is there a microphone now? Oh, there's one coming your way.
For those that may not know what their gift is, what would you recommend on the pathway to find it?
Think small. And one lady makes a homemade Christmas card for me every year, and it is my favorite card. And when I called her up and told her I wanted to put her in my book, she said, "This is not possible." And I said, "We love your card. Everyone in our family looks forward to that card." So it's this whole notion of, like, think small. Again, avoid big, think small. And I once got in a debate with a TV personality on Squawk Box, and he said, "Well, what's the difference between a talent, a skill, a vocation?" And I said, no. I said, "You're missing the point. The key is think about your ability to touch someone else's heart. And I don't care if it's your day job. I don't care if it's your hobby. It doesn't matter. The point is, are you thinking beyond yourself?" So I think the key is to survey your life and how you intersect with people and the things that you do and that may or may not be something that you can develop even more. I once met a banker at Bank of America and who declared, "I don't have a whistle." And I said, "Oh, I bet you do. Let's talk." So we talked for like 15 minutes, and sure enough, it was so obvious what his whistle was, but he hadn't named it. And I think once you name something and once you embrace it, you're more likely to use it more and to be more volitional about it. So those are some suggestions. All right.
Okay, so two quick questions. What was the Bank of America guy's whistle? And number two, what were some of the other whistlers like in all of your competitions you've done over your life? Like, were some people only professional whistlers, or do they all have, like, day jobs? And what was that community like?
I don't know if there are any truly professional full-time whistlers. It's a travesty, I know. But, okay, trust me. Okay, that's just, so the Bank of America's guy's whistle was his passion and an actual action in helping people in inner city Washington get banked. So he grew up in Anacostia and did good and then got this great job. So now he goes back into the inner city to help people get small loans and to help start small businesses and to feel comfortable with the banking system. And when he talked about it, his eyes lit up and talked about some of the specific people he had helped. I mean, that's a whistle where he's really taking his passion and his knowledge in this case and touching individual people with that gift. So it really impressed me. I actually put him in, he's referenced in the book as a result of that. But I am amazed at how many people declare they don't have a whistle. And I just say, take some time, think about it, And if you truly can't find it, then you need to find it, because I think we have a duty, us as Christians and Catholics, to actually make the world a better place and not just wait for others to do it. And then in terms of the other one, the bell curve applies to the whistling competition. So anyone who knows the bell curve. So there are usually around 50 adults who come to the competition. They're literally from all around the world. And I'd say around 20% of them are like fine, and you know, they're as good as anyone on the street. And then I probably sound like really rude when I say that, but I'm sorry. But I embrace whistling at all levels. I'm just, when I compete though, I am a ferocious competitor, because I go there to win, not to just like hang out with all the whistlers, which, trust me. Because as my wife says, it is a subculture. And this is the scary part. She said, "I'm the normal one," which really tells you something. This is my wife, nonetheless. And then there's the whole gradation between like fine And all the way to like the five people who are the best whistlers in the world. They will knock your socks off. There is, and I have lots of videos you can watch on YouTube and my website, but there's a guy from the Netherlands named Geert Chatroux, who I believe is the best whistler in the world today. And he's really, really wonderful. When we competed, we had two divisions, popular and classical. I beat him in popular, he beat me in classical, but he beat me a little more, so he won first prize that year. But I beat him in pop, so at least I have that. Yes, sir.
How closely related are singing and whistling? Do I take it it's the same range? You can sing and you can whistle. And secondly, for those of us who like to whistle but are not international competitors or so, how can we improve? How can we practice?
Okay, so singing and whistling have nothing to do with each other, absolutely nothing, because your voice is controlled by your vocal cords, and the actual whistle sound comes about by air passing through your lips, if that's how you whistle. I can whistle with my tongue also. So those are some funky techniques. But the point is this, is that the way you get pitch or high or low is using your tongue to either make the chamber in your mouth a little smaller, and that gets you a higher note, or you pull your tongue down, and that gets you a lower note. So there's no difference there. The only similarity for me between singing and whistling is that singing in choirs for almost 20 years taught me how to be a good musician, which is just all about shaping notes and intonation and song selection and that kind of stuff. And in terms of how to get better, the practice. When I once did a Graceland pilgrimage where I whistled for almost 5 hours every day for a week. Of course, I was alone. No one could tolerate that. And so I practice a lot. I practice an hour a day, even now, because it's just fun. And I put on my favorite music, and which are Strauss waltzes, and I waltz along while I'm driving to work. And so practice a lot, and then pay close attention to the notes and. You know, in terms of pitch and the like, and develop your repertoire, and then also try to push your bounds of your highs and your lows, and you can just eke them out little by little. If you have a 1-octave range, if you take your time, you'll get a 2-octave range in a year or two, just by pushing the bottom and the top, but just incremental. I'm a big believer in incrementalism. Just take your time and just push it along little by little.
Process all aspects of your life versus in one component. Like at work, you know, maybe you change people's lives through your work versus it's some sort of gift that can touch whether or not you're on the subway or some other place. I'm trying to think of that in terms of
understanding when you're thinking about this gift. Or, you know, you talked about the difference between talents and stuff like that, but also just does it cross all aspects of your life typically?
Yeah, well, I think you can have more than one gift. My other whistle is mentoring. You know, I mentor college seniors and people right out of college on how to think through their careers using my day job, which is communications and marketing, to help them think through how they market themselves. So no one should be limited to having one so-called whistle. And even if you're a teacher and you've dedicated your life to that, you know, that can be your whistle. And there are ways to share that outside of the classroom too. So I think thinking expansively about kind of who you are, what you do, where your talents are, what you have and what you can develop, and then thinking where it intersects with people. You know, I think a lot of life is discernment and figuring out, you know, taking your time to think things through. Your daily interactions with people, and then you're kind of looking at your skills and how you interact with people, how they react to you, and you know, a picture will emerge over time through a period of discernment. So, and that should be an ongoing type thing. I think all people of faith should be discerning day in and day out of, you know, are we making an impact or not, using the gifts, the spiritual gifts that God gave us. And it's a tough question, but I think the key is thinking hard about it and thinking small, but being kind of judicious in your thought, and then seeing what works and what doesn't. And your day in and day out, you see what people react to, and you have a good sense of what your skills and talents are and the like. All right. So I have a book. If you want to buy it, I'll be back there and I'm happy to sign it. Thank you.